Well, I wanted to start off with a word of thanks. Many of you here in the class helped us put on our first creation conference, where we actually go on the road on someone else's turf, and you know that's a bit of a challenge because you're not in control of everything. And several of you, as I look out in the class, did help us do that. And by the way, when we were at Christ Church of the Valley, we got requests from other churches in this area, larger churches, to do this again. So probably sometime next year or in 2007, we'll do another creation conference in this area. But after next Sunday, I'm going to be catching a plane for Chicago, and the Willow Creek Community Church is going to have our whole team come out and do a conference there. And they're going to professionally record the whole thing on both audio and video. And this is something that they're going to be packaging for. I mean, it's a denomination now. Willow Creek started off just as one big church, but it's become a denomination. And they're going to make this available to all their smaller churches, and we'll be able to use it as well for training people. And I wasn't with you last Sunday because Ken Samples and I flew to Tulsa, Oklahoma. And it was an interesting opportunity. We were on a TV program called E-Style, and we had no idea what E-Style was all about. But it was really interesting just to observe what's happening. It's an outreach development from the Black Christian community. So they're targeting Blacks, and the whole thing about E-Style is to try to build excellence of style within the Black Christian community. And so we were the first to appear on their TV show. And what they're looking for is, I mean, the leaders there have identified that within the Black Christian community, the intellectual content hasn't been as of high a quality as it needs to be. And so their comment is, we're trying to elevate the business ethics and lifestyle ethics and of the Black community. We want to do the same thing at an intellectual level. And so they were very pleased with what we had to offer. And then they're also doing a youth outreach where they're trying to do the same thing with the youth. They said, we need to catch these people before they become adults. So they were excited to get Journey Toward Creation in our video on UFOs, the UFO hypothesis. So we gave them permission to use that for their youth TV show as well. And we also had a chance to talk to them afterwards because, we were invited by them to come, but we noticed that many within the Christian community have heard about this. I never heard that this was even happening. It was brand new to me, but evidently many in the Christian community have heard about this development, and these people have been bombarded, and they have especially been bombarded by the younger community. I mean, just all kinds of stuff was there, and they were going that afternoon to interview Carl Bond. I said, look, if you're really serious about building excellence in terms of education and the intellectual thing, you need to put all this stuff to the test and not just take everything that the Christian community throws at you. So just because our skin is white doesn't mean everything we got to tell you is true. I mean, you really need to put this stuff to the test. And they took that very seriously and said they'd be back in touch with us. So, and they got a great magazine. I was really impressed with the magazine. I meant to bring you a copy so you can see what it's all about. But the new development that I'm frankly quite excited about. So what I want to do this morning, as we get into Job 39, we're going to be talking about donkeys today. You know, we talked about, it's interesting, as you go through Job 39, it mentions certain kinds of animals, and there's an apologetic point with each animal that it discussed. But I heard that Rich Dean gave you some exciting biology last week. I'm going to start off with some new discoveries that actually tie in with what we're doing in Job 39. It's in this latest issue of Science Magazine. And I promise you it won't be as complex as what Richard was talking about last week. And, people talk about how tough it is to follow these biochemists along and biologists. But frankly, I think it's all vocabulary. I mean, we in physics and astronomy, when we come up with some new thing we want to tell the public about, we call it a pulsar, or we call it a pion or a meson. It's only two syllables. But when a biologist makes a discovery, he attaches a name that's got six syllables to it. And, so I think part of what Richard is having to overcome with all of you is just teaching the vocabulary before you can get down to the point. So, the discovery I wanted to share with you is It's a bacterium that they've known about a long time, but they had no idea how important a role it plays in the support of advanced life. And it was done by a German couple. One of them, the wife, is a microbiologist, and she's married to a husband who's a geophysicist. And they must have been talking over the dinner table, and then they just decided to collaborate on this bacterium. And as I go through this, you'll understand why it takes both a geophysicist and a microbiologist to get down to all this. Now, what really surprised me is this particular species of bacterium is so large, you can see the individual cells with the naked eye. These are the largest bacterial life forms on the planet. I mean, to give you an idea how big we're talking about, it's almost 1 millimeter in diameter. So a millimeter is, what, about that much? So, you know, you can actually see the individual cells that are swimming around in the ocean. Huge cells. It's hard to even imagine that a cell could be that big and still operate as a cell. So that's not what's the heart of the discovery here. It's discovering that these bacteria, and you'll love the name they came up with this, Thiomargarita namibiensis. Now, namibiensis comes from the fact that it was discovered off of Namibia. So that's where they got that from. Thiomargarita, well, you can tell what they must have been drinking when they came up with the name of this bacterium. So, and you know, whoever makes the discovery is allowed to attach the name to it, but the rule is it's got to follow a certain pattern, it's got to have so many syllables in it, and it's got to be Latin. So, right. And it's like every species name is like that. So you just have to live with that. So just think of it as, well, I'll give you an easy name for it. Large sulfur bacterium, okay? Because it's processing sulfur. And this is a bacterium that they discovered lives in larger populations than they thought. You think the fact that they can actually see these things with the naked eye would be easy to understand what's going on. But the problem is they live in marine sediments. And not too many people go down and mess around in marine sediment, so they really had no idea just how tremendous a portion of the biomass these bacteria make up, and also what they do. And you know, the really amazing thing as I was reading this article about this bacterium, it's able to thrive under both oxic and anoxic conditions, and that just simply means environments where there's lots of oxygen and environments where there's no oxygen at all. And, you know, for a biochemist, I'm not a biochemist, but when Fuzz comes here, you can just talk to him. The kinds of metabolic processes that work under oxygen-rich environments are radically different from those that work under no oxygen environments. And that may explain why this cell, this bacterium, is so large. It's got design within it that allows it to survive under both conditions. And as far as I know, it's the only bacterium. Well, there's two other species of bacteria that do the same thing. They're also very large and they live in the same area. So there's three different species. But this is the most significant of the species. Now, what it does is by living in this marine sediment environment, it's predominantly anoxic. So most of the marine sediments, there's no oxygen at all. But these marine sediments are soft. It's not like solid rock. They're a little bit soft. And occasionally in the course of its life cycle, this bacterium comes into contact with oxygen-rich water. Not very often. Only in a very tiny percentage of its life cycle does it make that contact. But when it makes contact with oxygen-rich water, what it does is it takes in tremendous amounts of nitrate. You know, with oxygen present, you can get a metabolic reaction that allows this thing to accumulate lots of nitrate. And again, it explains why the cell is so big. It needs to be big enough that it can store enough nitrate that when it goes into the oxygen-free environment, it can live off those nitrates for literally many, many months. And so there's this, you know, during the few days that it makes contact with the oxygen-rich water, it uses that brief period of time to build up all these nitrate stores, and then when it goes back into an oxygen-free environment, it's able to live off of that nitrate. But its primary energy mechanism is sulfide oxidation. That's what keeps this bacterium going. is oxidizing sulfide. And you say, well, where does it get the sulfide? Well, it gets the sulfide from sulfate-reducing bacteria. And particularly in the early history of the Earth, for, you know, between 3.8 billion years ago and about 3/4 billion years ago, sulfate-reducing bacteria were dominant. They were kind of the dominant life form on the face of the Earth. And what these bacteria do is they take soluble sulfur, soluble metals, combine them with sulfur, and they make sulfates. And what this, and pardon me, and they make all these metallic sulfides. And what that does is it converts metal that is soluble into insoluble form. Now, the important thing about that is planet Earth in the beginning was loaded with soluble metals. Metals like chromium, zinc, silver, gold, that were iron, that were in soluble form. And in soluble form, they would have been deadly to advanced life. But these bacteria literally work for billions of years to convert these metals from a soluble form into an insoluble form. Now, this Thiomargarita nambiensis, I got to read this, I can't just pull it off the top like Richard can. What this bacterium does, I'm going to just call it TN from now on, just to make it easy, so it's a TN virus bacterium. This TN bacterium feeds on all the metallic sulfides that are made by these sulfate-reducing bacteria and produces phosphorite. And then when these creatures die, they're in the sediments already. When they die, they create these rich mats of phosphorite. And then thanks to the way the oceans are designed and plate tectonics, this phosphorite gets recycled. It gets moved through the crust of the Earth and becomes available for future life forms as this phosphor gets exposed to the surface of the Earth and to the water again. And the whole point of this article is that without these bacteria, you would not have a stable phosphorus cycle in the environment of the Earth. And phosphorus is not a very common element. I think it's 0.0007% of the... No, it's not that bad. It's 0.007%. And you may want to check that figure. It could be off a little bit. I'm trying to pull it from memory of all the stuff that exists of ordinary matter in the universe. Phosphorus is rare in the universe. Planet Earth is very phosphorus rich in terms of bodies, and phosphorus is critical for life. The DNA and the RNA is basically built on phosphorus ladders. And so one of the challenges of life is, how does it get the phosphorus? In fact, when Fuzz and I were at the last Origins of Life conference, one statement that a scientist made when he came to the podium to give his lecture was what he called the phosphorus miracle of life. In fact, evidently in this magazine Science, a paper was submitted, and the whole theme is that it's a miracle that we have phosphorus on planet Earth, and it's a miracle that this phosphorus cycles through the environment in such a way that we can have DNA and RNA as the building blocks of life. And the paper was rejected because it used the word miracle too many times in the course of the paper. But it was all available as a preprint. Everybody was aware of it. The paper did get published, but they took the word miracle out of all the... that was edited out. On the other hand, as you read the paper, it's quite clear that the authors are utterly amazed that, number one, we have a planet with that much phosphorus, and number two, the phosphorus gets cycled through the environment. But not until last week did we have any idea what's responsible for the cycling of the phosphorus. And what it is this amazing bacterium that's designed so it can live under oxygen-rich environments as well as oxygen-free environments, and it's able to take advantage of all the sulfides produced by these sulfate-reducing bacteria. And you know, what it basically does is it sits there in the sediments. The sulfate-reducing bacteria are up in the water, and all the stuff gets washed down into the sediments, and then it feeds on those sulfides, produces the phosphorite, deposits that, and then that is what really keeps phosphorus cycling through the environment. So, next time you celebrate Thanksgiving with your family, you might want to take a few minutes to thank God for the amazing design of Thiomargarita nambiensis. So I'll try to remember that for our own Thanksgiving. So now, one other thing I'll share with you before we get into our Job study is that in the same, no, not the same issue, same week, Nature came out and published a very similar article, which was that, you know, within the oceans, we have all these bacteria that are dying. And the death of these bacteria and algae produce what they call, what's the technical term here? Yes, oceanic dissolved organic carbon. And, you know, when you're kind of snorkeling in the water, you see all this kind of a haze in the water. Well, a lot of that is just dissolved organic material. And it kind of floats up there at the surface. And the problem that's addressed by these scientists, a couple of American microbiologists, is what causes that organic carbon that's dissolved in the water and floating around the top surface of the water to get into the carbon cycle of the Earth. And what they were able to first establish is that this accounts for about 20% of the total carbon that gets cycled through the Earth's environment. And they said, you know, what is it that causes this stuff to get into the cycle? And what I mean by getting into the cycle, what causes it to deposit on the floor of the ocean where plate tectonics can bury it into the crust of the Earth and to produce future islands and continents with it? How does it get down to the bottom of the ocean? And what they discovered in this article, talking to a bunch of chemists, is that this stuff gets remineralized. You know, it's mineralized when it's part of a life form, and then when the creatures die, it kind of floats as this organic material. But if it's simply unprocessed, then it just stays up there at the surface and doesn't become available for the carbon cycle. But when it gets remineralized in the water, and the whole point there is the oceans are designed in such a way, the circulatory patterns, the depth of the ocean, the temperature of the ocean, and the salinity of the ocean. I don't know why the ocean is as salty as it is. All this is designed in such a way to set up a rather efficient mineralization of this floating organic stuff that's in the waters. And what that does is it makes it heavy enough that it begins to fall down to the bottom of the ocean. And it collects at the bottom of the ocean where plate tectonics can now process it as the crust of the Earth, and then it becomes available 100 million years later as future islands and continents form thanks to plate tectonic activity. Now, what I found interesting is why these microbiologists got into all of this in the first place, and apparently their research interest is global warming. And they said what they're looking for are ways to pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And what caused them to study this organic material to say, well, if we can find a more efficient way to pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, put it in the ocean, and somehow get it into the carbon cycle, then maybe this could be a big help for a global warming problem. And what they discovered indeed is that the rate of remineralization of this carbon is too low, then not enough carbon dioxide gets removed from the atmosphere. The atmosphere becomes too efficient to trap heat. But if the remineralization rate is too high, you'll pull too much carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and this again will disturb the temperature balance of the Earth. And all this is in the background of the sun getting progressively brighter and brighter, and you need mechanisms that are progressively more and more efficient in pulling carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, putting into an organic carbon form, then getting this carbon to deposit at the bottom of the ocean. And hey, we were talking about this book, Rare Earth. It's written by an atheist and an agnostic astronomer and an atheist paleontologist. But one of the things that excites us about that book is they talk about how amazingly designed the oceans of planet Earth are and the plate tectonics to make sure these cycles. I've only talked about two. We've talked about the phosphorus cycle and the carbon cycle. But there's a sulfur cycle as well. And there's a nitrogen cycle. And none of these cycles will run at the right rate unless the oceans are a particular depth. What they describe in the book Rare Earth is that it's the depth of the water that allows water to go into a particular state. You may not be aware of this, but liquid water is six different states. And there's one particular state of water that takes form when you've got ocean depths of, say, 2 to 5 miles, and what that does is it forces the water at that bottom depth into a certain pressure and to a certain temperature, which I believe is called stage 6 water. And it's this particular stage of water that allows the chemical reaction to take place where mineral material that's on the floor of the crust gets converted into talc. And you know, most of you know that talc is pretty slippery. And it's that slippery talc that allows the plates, the tectonic plates, one to slide under one other and the other one to rise above it. And this results in the production of silicates, and the silicates are lighter than the basalts, and eventually this produces continents and islands. But none of that would happen unless you had lots of this stage 6 water. And to get stage 6 water, the water has to be a particular depth. And if it's not that depth, then this process doesn't work that efficiently. And then the whole point they make is, well, what if you got more water? And what if you got less water? No, the water has to be just right. And then you want the continents and the oceans to be distributed just right to make these mechanisms work. And you want the boundaries between the plates to be just right so that you can get this this slippage taking place. So, and you know, what drives the plate tectonics? Well, it's uranium and thorium and potassium decay, radioactive decay, which produces the energy that drives this, and that would have to be fine-tuned to make the plate tectonics work just right, and the oceans have to be fine-tuned. And if that's not in place, none of these cycles will work appropriately. But also what I'm revealing to you here, it's not just that you need finely-tuned oceans and continents and finely-tuned plate tectonic energy-driving mechanisms. You have to make sure that you've got the right life forms existing at the right time so that you get appropriate deposition of this carbon and phosphorus and sulfur and nitrogen. Now, this stuff has got to get to the bottom of the ocean. And how does it get to the bottom of the ocean? It's this complex interplay between primarily bacterial species that makes this whole thing work. And one of the things you'll see in our Origins of Life book that Fuzz and I have put out is that this really explains why the origin of life is not a single bacterium. I mean, this is the myth of the origin of life community, that we all evolved from one common ancestor, one bacterial species. But none of these mechanisms work well unless you've got a suite of bacteria symbiotically supporting one another so that these cycles will work. For example, this Biomargarita nambiensis can't do its thing unless the planet is loaded with sulfate-reducing bacteria. So you need both working together to make this process work. We got a question over here? Well, I can't pull this off the top of my head, but the book Rare Earth actually gets into these different types of water that you need. Although it doesn't do it thoroughly, there's a paper we have referenced. If you go to our reasons.org website and actually go through today's new Reasons to Believe, one of the discoveries of about a year ago, we actually give you all the references to these different stages of water. In fact, we just posted a new discovery this past week on water, which talks about how water has this incredible property that it forms clusters. Now, you pick up a glass of water here. You know, I don't think about the fact that it's liquid. I just think, well, it's just a bunch of water molecules running around. But there's a new research study that shows that, you know, say in a glass of water, and actually more efficiently in the ocean, you get these clusters forming. And the clusters are like 50 water molecules that form a colony. So when you drink a glass of water, you might want to think about the fact there are actually colonies existing within the water. Where 50 or so water molecules will bond together. And when they bond together like this, what they do is they kind of form a surface. And the outer surface of this aggregate of 50 water molecules is a surface that has all these excess electrons attached to it. And this is critical to make metabolic reactions work within the cell. The cell takes advantage of these water aggregates so that it can get an efficient electron transfer going on to make the proteins work. Well, actually, it has to do with the orientation of the hydrogen atoms relative to the oxygen atom, and then the way the electrons orbit around the oxygen and the hydrogen atoms within the molecule. So it takes exquisite fine-tuning of the oxygen atom, the hydrogen atom, and then the orientation. Most of you know that you've got oxygen here and then two hydrogens come out, but they come out at an angle of 109 degrees. And a 109 degree angle must be critically fine-tuned for water to be able to exhibit its properties. It explains why, for example, liquid water is in a denser state than frozen water. Whereas for other materials, it's always a solid component that is densest. And if that were the case, life would be impossible in the universe. It's critical that the solvent of life be one where it's densest in the liquid state. No, not all water clusters like that, but water does have the capacity to form what they call these ionic clusters, where, you know, 30 to 50 water molecules would get together, form a colony, and a colony in such a way that forms this electron-rich skin about it. Now, it can work the other way, too. It can also form an electron-poor skin. But, you know, in physics, you can make these electron transfer reactions work if you've got a paucity of electrons or if you've got an excess of electrons. It really doesn't matter. Because one will pull electrons, one will give electrons. Okay, the exact physics, the theoretical physics behind why water forms these kinds of clusters, that has not yet been fully explored. The paper we're posting on the website, I think it got posted a couple of days ago, or it'll get posted next week, basically says, it talks about how chemists discovered that water had this property. So there's an experiment done to look at water and see what kinds of aggregates it formed. They knew already it formed some kind of aggregate, but they didn't know what the aggregates were like or the properties that the aggregates manifested. That much has been discovered. What is yet to be discovered is the theoretical physics behind this whole thing that explains why water and only water has that property. And that is critical. It's the only fluid we know of that can form these aggregates where you get these electron-rich skins. Yeah. Yes. There are lots of elements in the atomic chart that are not used by biological systems. There are lots that are toxic to biological systems. Some are neutral. A lot of them are toxic, even in the smallest amount. What you can do, in fact, it's in our catalog. We have a book. I don't think it's here on the table. But we have a book called The Elements. And these books have been around for decades. But the reason why we put this in our catalog is that this is one book in The Elements that talks about the biological benefits of each element, what those benefits are, then the toxicity of each of the elements. And what's really interesting is there are 22 elements that are both toxic and necessary. You've got to have them or you'll die, but if you have too much of it, you will also die. They have to be just right. And that's really where scientists discovered the benefit of these sulfate-reducing bacteria. They make sure that all these elements come into that just right zone, where you don't have too much and you don't have too little. So yeah, we do need a little bit of water-soluble zinc in the environment. What you want is about one part per billion. But when life first was here on planet Earth, it was one part per million. And it took the sulfate-reducing bacterial activity to reduce it from one part per million down to one part per billion. Now, if we're one part per 10 billion, we would die. And, you know, you go a factor of 10 the other way, one part per 100 million, we would also die. So when you go to the health food store, don't load up too much on those, what we call vital poisons. I know chromium is a big push these days. Well, chromium is one of those vital poisons. Most Americans don't have enough chromium in their diet. So if you start pushing back too many of those chromium pills, you'll do yourself some harm. So, but there's some that have no benefit at all. They're simply toxic. On the other hand, you might say, well, why all these elements? Well, in order to get the beneficial elements, you must produce those other elements as part of the nucleosynthesis. The stars make those elements, and to make the good ones, they've got to make a few of the neutral ones and make a few of the toxic ones to boot. But the amazing thing is, we human beings today, in terms of supporting our technology, we make use of the entire atomic chart. there's not one element in the atomic chart, except for the ones we've made artificially, that doesn't have value in sustaining human civilization. So all 98 that occur naturally play a vital role in sustaining our civilization and technology. You know, the eyepieces that we use on our star parties, the really good eyepieces are made with lanthanum glass. Now, lanthanum is not something you need to support your physical body, but it does have, you know, commercial value that is significant, but it's rare. Not a lot of it exists. Well, it's good that not a lot of it exists, because if a whole lot existed, that would be a problem for life. Okay, how about if we move into Job 38? Let's see, we've got other questions. Let's spend some time there. Job 39, pardon me. And if you haven't been with us for a couple of weeks, what we've been doing is going through the creation accounts that are in the Bible. And we spent, a couple of years going through the ones in the book of Genesis, and probably a couple of years now, and maybe not that long, in the book of Job. But we did look at Job 9, which is a major creation account early in the book of Job. And this is one of the biggest creation accounts in the Bible, Job 38 through to Job 42. And Job 38 to 42 is outlined a lot like the book of Genesis, in the sense that in Genesis chapter 1, you see God taking us through his creation activity in three stages. Stage 1, he talks to us about the physical creation. Stage 2, the soulish creation. And last of all, the spirit creation in terms of planet Earth. Well, this portion of Scripture is organized the same way. Job 38 focuses on the physical creation. Job 39 through to 41 focuses on the soulish creation. And then Job 42, the last chapter, in the book of Job, focuses on the spirit creation. So Job 38 talks about physical things and life forms that are purely physical in nature. And then Job 39 gets us into those life forms that are not purely physical, but are also soulish. And by soulish, it's referring to those creatures that manifest mind, will, and emotions. And one of the ways this chapter brings this out is that it manifests care for one another. You know, some species of life, they're only out for themselves. But these soulish creatures that we see common to all soulish creatures is the parents care for the young. They provide for the young in some way or form. And on that basis, there's a debate going on amongst biologists. All biologists recognize that every bird and mammal species falls in this category of manifesting this quality that the Bible calls soulishness. Where it becomes debatable is whether or not a few of the reptiles also fall into this category. And so crocodiles, for example, are put forward as an example of a reptilian life form where the mothers do care for their young. Maybe not to the same degree as birds and mammals, but they do that. And it's kind of played out in the Hebrew word for soulish creature. The word is nephesh. There's another word also called basar. And as you go throughout the Bible, sometimes the word nephesh is used only for birds and mammals. Other times it's used for the bigger, higher reptilian life forms. And maybe what we're seeing in the Bible is a little different classification system than we see in biology. Biology classifies reptiles differently than it does birds, even though both have scales and both lay eggs. But what the Bible really gets at is it's a soulish animal if there is this manifestation of mind, will, and emotion in an attempt to provide some element of care. So we'll use that definition. But what's interesting about Job 39 is it doesn't talk about all the birds and mammals in the face of the earth. It really addresses those birds and mammals that human beings think they know the most about. And it's kind of the same theme as what you see in Job 38. Job 38, God asked 59 or 60 questions to the assembled five men, and they get a score of 0 on the test. And now he asks them only 17 questions. So part 2 of the test has only got 17 questions on it. But it's kind of like what he does in Job 38. It's like, you know, if you were really doing what I asked you to do in Genesis chapter 1, the command that God gave us to wisely manage the resources of the whole planet for the benefit of all life, you should be able to answer all these questions. And so it's one way of exposing the fact that we're really not fulfilling the command that God has given us. Well, likewise here in Job 39, if we're really fulfilling the command that God had given us in Genesis chapter 1, we shouldn't have any trouble answering these 17 questions. And as we mentioned earlier, it begins with the animal that we human beings, or at least in the context of the time of Job, that they thought they knew the most about. Goats were the first species of life that human beings had domesticated. We've been able to determine the date of that, the date of extensive goat domestication 10,000 years ago, northwest Mesopotamia, the same location as most Bible commentaries put for the landing of Noah's Ark and the Garden of Eden. Goats were the first creatures that were domesticated, and as I explained to you, that's easy to figure out. Goats are incredibly friendly. If you ever meet wild goats when you're in the Rockies or up there in Canada or Alaska, all you got to do is sit down, and even if you got no lunch, they're right there nibbling on your shirt, and you know, they want affection from you. And you can domesticate a wild goat in a few seconds, literally. There's really no creature easier to domesticate than a goat. And so it's no big deal that those were domesticated. And it also talks about deer. And deer, too, were domesticated early by some peoples. You say, well, why don't we do that today? Well, there are people here in America that domesticate deer. The problem is we've found other animals that are commercially more productive than deer are. And so they're tended to just let go. But deer, probably next to goats, are quite easy to domesticate. Now, if you come across a wild deer, it's not likely to come up to you like a goat will and literally put its head in your hand. But deer, likewise, are easy to domesticate. I think one reason why they don't come up to people as easily as they used to is that they're hunted. It's kind of the favorite wild hunting animal, at least here in America. But I've been in places in Canada where deer have never been hunted. And in places like that, they come right up to you. Not quite as quickly as a goat, but I can tell you, just sit down and have lunch, the deer will be there, and they'll have their nose right in your lunch bag. They will come up to you. Whereas that's not the case with elk and moose. Even if you've got lunch there, they're not going to come near you. But the goats, they'll come close to you even without lunch. But then it asks all these questions about the goats and the deer, and particularly focuses on the birthing process. This is why I spent some time talking to you about just how amazing mammals are, and that this is not something that the evolutionary paradigm would at all expect. If you remember, in fact, this is up on our reasons.org website, the fact that with mammals, the only way mammals make it is that they transition from feeding on the placenta to feeding on the mother's milk. But there's about a 72-hour window for that transition, which means that this young baby that comes out of the womb of the mother is in danger of starving to death. And how with mammals, they have just discovered that there's this autophagy mechanism that kicks in, where the cells of mammals actually undergo a self-feeding process, where the cells feed on their own cytoplasm to keep the energy mechanisms going so that the baby won't die. And this is able to be sustained for those 72 hours until a new metabolic process kicks in, namely the mother's milk. And then the question is, how would you ever expect that to evolve from species that didn't have that capacity? You know, it's really quite a strange transition to go from no autophagy, no self-feeding on the cell's own cytoplasm, to being able to do that. And of course, this has all controlled by genes that tell the newborn when to kick in with this autophagy and when to shut it off. And obviously, if you kick it in too soon, it's going to cause a problem because it's going to disrupt the placental feeding. And if you shut it off too late, that's going to interfere with the feeding on milk. And there's only a limited time in which autophagy itself won't bring death. If the cell consumes too much of its cytoplasm, it will die. So, you know, this is really quite incredible that we live on this planet that's got mammals at all. And evolutionists have no idea to explain the origin of mammalian life. One of the questions that asks you, do you count the months until they bear. And this is something we're describing in our Reasons to Believe office. We seem to just consider it as routine that today in the 21st century, we know the gestation period of every mammal on the planet. You know, it's something everybody knows. But what we discovered in our study is that was not the case until about 100 to 200 years ago. People really didn't have much of an idea on the gestation periods at all. So in the context of this question, do you count the months till they bear? Do you know the time that they give birth? In the context of Job and his four friends, they had no idea. And today we have a good idea. You know, one of the more dramatic examples of that, was brought up by Krista Bontrager when she gave her talk at our conference on, you know, what do the different religions and the holy books of the world say about science. And this is beautifully brought out in a book. I don't know whether it's at our table or not, but one of the books that we distribute is by a medical doctor, William Campbell. And it's a response to a book put out by the Muslims by Maurice Pakai on science, the Bible, and the Quran, where Maurice Pakai, as an Islamic medical doctor, tries to claim that the Bible is filled with scientific errors and the Quran is filled with scientific accuracies, and therefore Islam is the way to go. Well, William Campbell, who had been serving as a missionary in North Africa for 25 years, he had enough of this and said, I'm going to produce a book. But the book doesn't merely refute Maurice Pakai's material. It goes much beyond that. But one of the things he points out is just how off the Quran was on gestation periods. In fact, the Quran was off on the gestation period even for the human species. You know, you think that's a tough error to make. But what is stated in the Quran is that the gestation period for a woman is 6 months. And how that came about is that you've got men, this is the problem, you've got men running society, all right? Men would look at their wives and they wouldn't notice their wife getting any bigger until about the third or fourth month. And so they would count from that time to when the time that the baby gave birth, and therefore they record in the Quran that it was 6 months. And, you know, so today we know it's 9 months. But this is a common problem in early times, is that people look at all these animals and they just couldn't figure out the gestation periods. And actually, if you read in the history of animal breeding, it took them a while to figure out exactly, you know, when they should have the animals breed in terms of when they wanted the babies to come. This wasn't common knowledge, and they were off by a very considerable period of time. And so this explains why this is in the context here. In other words, hey, I gave you this mandate to manage the resources for the benefit of all life on planet Earth. Don't you think one of the first things you'd like to learn is what the gestation periods of all these mammals are, especially the mammals that you're using to sustain your agricultural economy? Wouldn't it be a good idea to figure out what the gestation period of a goat is so that you can better manage your goat herd? And they really didn't know. And so God is exposing, look, this is fundamental from the command I gave you. And keep in mind that for 37 chapters, we have these five men debating creation and science and really trying to pat one another on the back about how much they know. And God just comes in and says, well, what about the gestation periods of these goats that you think you know so much about? And they really don't have that clue. But question over here. Well, you're right. Accurate measures weren't made until this century. And what was happening with these ancient herdsmen is that none of them had it figured out. But it wasn't common knowledge amongst the people. Some shepherds would know, some would not. Some were better. I mean, one of the things you see in the book of Genesis is that Jacob was having much more success with his breeding of sheep and goats than Laban, his father-in-law, was. And I would attribute that to the fact that Jacob was much more in tune with the science of what was going on with sheep and goats than his father-in-law was, and therefore had a lot more productivity. But, you know, being interested in the fact that, you know, a certain level of improvement is all I'm really interested in, and I got thousands of animals here, it wasn't the kind of scientific study we do today where we can pin it down to a day or two. But, you know, it's phenomenal to think about our own species. I mean, I'm mystified at how the Quran could get it that wrong, have it 6 months instead of 9 months. You don't have to be a modern-day scientist to figure out that there's 9 months between fertilization and the baby coming out of the womb. You know, any couple should be able to figure that out in the course of raising the children. And yet here we've got this book that is viewed as the word of truth by nearly a billion people on the face of the earth, and yet it's got these kinds of blatant scientific errors in it. By the way, William Campbell documents over 100 errors of that nature in the Quran. It's not just once or twice. It's all over the place in the Quran that it makes these really egregious scientific errors. Yeah. Well, most of the Quran is not very specific on scientific issues. I mean, when I first read the Quran, what impressed me was just how vague it was and how, yeah, it keeps it safe. But there are a few places in the Quran where it gets really specific. And where it does, that's where you see these blatant scientific misstatements. Well, at least those who put the Quran into print and tried to claim it was the Word of God. Yeah. You get your hand up? Okay, that's fine. All right. Okay. It says, who let the wild donkey go free? This is verse 5. Who untied his rope? I gave him the wasteland as his home, the salt flats as his habitat. He laughs at the commotion of the town. He does not hear a driver shout. He ranges the hills for his pasture and searches for any green thing. And so what you notice here is it's going from goats to deer, and now it's talking about the donkey. You know, deer is a creature we tend to just let run wild, but we take advantage of it. It's a good animal to hunt. Goats, we domesticate. And here it's talking about donkeys who seem to be equally at home, domesticated, and wild. And then it's going to move on to the cows. And, you know, just what a critical role cows play in our economy. And what's talking about, notice the pattern here. Donkeys are easier to domesticate than cows. Cows, by the way, are quite difficult to domesticate. And it's incredible when you think of how dependent we are on cows today. But cows are difficult to domesticate. And it's something that actually tells us here in the book of Job. It talks about the wild cow and how this wild cow is likely to cause you a lot of harm. It's not a creature like a goat that comes up to you and you can pet it and it follows you around for the rest of your life. You know, goats are like that. Once they make friends with you, boy, you can't get rid of them. So how do you housebreak a cow? I kind of scared my mother once when I was about 7 years old because there was this goat that was loose in our neighborhood. And the goat took a liking to me right away, and I couldn't get rid of the goat. So I came home from school, and the goat was right there behind me. Came into our house, and my mother kind of freaked out. And we tried to get rid of the goat, but every time she'd chew the goat away, the goat would come back and just hang by me. And goats are like that. Once you domesticate them, you can't get rid of them. But cows aren't like that. And also it talks, and this is a transition here. We're getting a transition between the goats, which are incredibly domesticatable, and cows, which are very difficult to domesticate, and then we've got donkeys, which are kind of in between. And so the Lord here is kind of taking these five ancient scientists through these different creatures and say, these are the animals you think you know a lot about. Let me ask you some questions about the animals. And what he's really bringing about in the donkey is this. How do you explain the fact that the donkey is somewhat easy to domesticate, but is quite easily able to go from one state to another state, a domesticated state to a wild state, from a wild state to a domesticated state, and back again? And that is one thing that scientists have noted about donkeys, is that they're very easily able to go back and forth. Whereas some animals, when you domesticate them and then throw them back into the wild, they have a very difficult time adapting. Most of our household pets would have a difficult time going back into the wild. And goats would have a difficult time. They'll make it, but it's a difficult transition for them. Donkeys, it's no big deal. And you know, here they are in your home, and you're feeding them regularly. And yet if they go out into the wasteland and you somehow lose contact with them, they're able to quickly adapt to living, as he points out here, under rather harsh environments. It's not easy being a wild donkey. and that's the point it makes here. I mean, here it is living in the wasteland and the desert with salt flats, and yet it's able to find all the green things that are out there and survive quite well. Donkeys need to drink a lot, and you'd think, well, throwing a wild donkey or a domesticated donkey back into the desert is going to be death for that donkey, but somehow it's able to find the water. Donkeys are incredibly good at finding sources of water where conditions are quite dry, whereas that's not the case for, say, our pet dogs. You throw them out into the desert and they're not going to make it because they can't find the water. But the donkeys are able to find the water. And the whole point is this. You have a donkey that's been raised from birth as a domesticated donkey. What teaches it when you throw it out into the wild to have these amazing capabilities to find the green grass, the green plants, and the water? Its mother didn't teach him that, and yet somehow it's able to pick that all up. And this is another example. Yes, got a question back here, or someone just raising their hand? Okay. The question here is, how do you explain this design that we see in the donkey, that it's able to kind of go back and forth like this? You know, you can understand a creature having a capacity for domestication, but this creature's got a capacity to literally go both ways. And the question that the Lord is putting to these five men, can you figure this out? Yeah, we can put that question to scientists today. Can you figure out why the donkey has these capabilities? Now, where is it in the genes that a donkey would have this kind of capacity? As far as I know, maybe we can talk to Richard Dean when he comes back in the class. I don't think there's a good answer, even today, for why the donkey is able to manifest such incredible adaptability that doesn't seem to be dependent on whether or not it was raised by a mother in the wild and then was domesticated, or raised by a mother on a farm that never got to see the wild, but throw it out in the wild and immediately adapts to that wild condition quite well. Or you can take it from the wild condition and put it in a domesticated condition, and it adapts quite well to that as well. And so that may explain why donkeys have been such a favored creature by humans. They're just able to go both ways. If you lose them, don't worry about them. They're going to make it on their own. You know, if you lose them for a few weeks, they'll be fine. You bump into them again, you're going to be able to domesticate them again quite easily. Whereas that's not the case when you, say, have a dog that runs away from your home. And that dog has a hard time adapting to the wild environment, but if it does make the transition, just you try to bring that dog back into your home. It's not going to be easy for that dog to do it. It'll probably run away from you and wants nothing to do with you. Not the case with a donkey. And so this is a great animal to have lying around, because if you lost it, you know, it would be fine. And when you find it again, it'll come right back to you, and you just get it back, pulling your cart, whatever. And if you lose it again, that's fine. And that also explains why donkeys don't seem to worry too much about losing their masters. That's another factor about donkeys, is that, you know, they tend to wander off. But when they wander off, they're okay. And sometimes that's helpful when the conditions are a little bit strapped for caring for these animals. You can let them wander off. They're going to find their food, their water, even if you don't have food and water for them, and then they'll be just great. Could it be that God knew that the early humans would need an animal like that? I mean, today we really don't have that great of a need, given our modern technology, for animals like that. But put yourself 4, 5, 10,000 years ago, having an animal like a donkey would be a real asset. In fact, when you go into primitive cultures, you notice how many donkeys they have. You know, I went into Eastern Europe when the Soviets were still running the place, and donkeys are everywhere. I didn't see that many horses, but I sure saw a lot of donkeys. And you know, donkeys are great where you've got a low level of technology, because they're not that difficult to care for. If you lose them, that's fine. When you find them, you're okay. So this is a hard passage to teach on when you're in the 21st century. Say, donkeys, who cares? And, you know, today, and I mean, do you see many donkeys in the neighborhood here? You really don't. You do see a lot of horses, because horses are a great animal if you've got a high level of civilization technology to support them. But you do need a lot of money. I mean, if you know your own horses, you know that it takes a lot of money to keep them going. But the donkeys are great where you've got a low-tech culture. Yes. Mm-hmm. And they probably didn't have a lot of horses. Horses are kind of finicky. I mean, they need a certain kind of food, a certain kind of care. Where you were working up there in the Andes, it's high altitude, not a lot of food around. If you lose a horse, it'll probably die. If you lose a donkey, it'll do just okay. And when you find the donkey again, you can put it right back into service. So here we have a missionary that worked in a low-tech culture. You were working, I think, in, what was it, Peru? Bolivia. And well, Bolivia is probably the lowest tech culture of any nation in the Andes. And how many years did you work there? 7 years. So, okay, I probably should have you teaching this class about donkeys. So, I mean, I haven't had a lot of contact with donkeys, so I'm pretty ignorant when I come to these things. But we got a hand over here, yeah. If you go into the Levitical law, it does not say that we cannot mate animals of different species and get viable offspring. But it does tell us not to do that. So in the Levitical law, there was one of the Levitical laws was do not mate animals of different species together. But they don't do it. You have wild horses and wild donkeys, they will not mate to make mules. But if you force them to mate, then you can get a mule. That's always the case, yeah. You don't see wild mules from wild horses and wild donkeys. But, you know, we humans have the capacity to force that. I mean, likewise, I mean, the oceans, you don't see wolfins. But in aquaria, we are able to take a whale and a dolphin and force them to mate to make a wolfin. But you'll never find a wolfin out in the ocean. So the scriptures tell us in Levitical law that this is possible, that we can take closely related species and make this work. But when you do that, you always wind up with something like the mule, where it's not able to reproduce after its own kind. Some of them are able to reproduce, you know, like ligers, for example, but they can't reproduce after their own kind. They'll revert either to the lion or to the tiger. And again, lions and tigers in the wild will not mate with one another. You have to make that happen under human-controlled conditions. So, but yeah, we're going to see an interesting contrast here with the donkey and the cow. And by the way, the last creature that's addressed here is the horse, and how the horse is so much different than the donkey. But I think what happened with human beings is that we liked some of the features of the horse, we liked some of the features of the donkey, so we felt, well, let's make this mule, and we get a little bit of each. You get some interesting problems when you do that too. And you might say, well, why is there this law against this in the book of Leviticus? These kinds of creatures are much more difficult to care for. So mules are a different category. But mules played a critical role in the Civil War, for example. Now, they're good for walking down the Grand Canyon. So, what makes them so stubborn? Well, maybe we shouldn't have... Question here. It's a good idea to follow a donkey if you're lost in the desert and very thirsty. That donkey will probably find some water. On the other hand, the donkey is able to take advantage of water sources that are not easy for us to take advantage of, like finding some green grass. Well, finding some green grass and eating it is not going to do you a lot of good. But it will do the donkey some good, but it won't do you any good. Well, let's talk to a man who spent some time with donkeys here. I would suggest that donkeys aren't that stupid. They're quite smart animals. On the other hand, they're different from the horses. I mean, we're going to study this section about horses. And one of the things that's different about horses and donkeys, you can command a horse to do anything and it will do it. That's not true of a donkey. And so we get this idea. Horses are smart, donkeys are dumb. Well, maybe it's the other way around. The horses are dumb and the donkeys are smart. For example, you cannot get on top of a donkey and charge into battle. The donkey won't go. The horse will, but the donkey won't. Do you want to make any additional comments in defense of the donkey? Okay. But no, I would dispute the claim that donkeys are dumb. But they are domesticatable in a different fashion. So, And, you know, they're able to live under incredibly harsh conditions. Horses are not able to live under the harsh conditions that a donkey would. So if your horse gets loose in the desert, and you find that horse a month later, you'll probably find a dead horse. Or like up in the Andes, if a horse gets loose, it's probably not going to make it. But a donkey will make it. But there are certain things that you can do with a horse that you can't do with a donkey. And likewise, the ox, which is very difficult to domesticate, there's certain things you can do with that. But there's kind of a pattern as we go down here in terms of domestication. So we start off with the goats and the deer that are easy to domesticate. And then one step up from that are these donkeys. Then it gets into the difficult ones. And it mentions the ox, the ostrich, and the horse. Now, these days, we're able to domesticate all three. In fact, it's only recently that people have started to domesticate ostriches. But they're discovering that ostriches, in terms of meat production, are ahead of cows. And we went for cows because of the fact that they were efficient meat and milk producers. Although what I found in my study is that the primary reason why cows were domesticated was not because they were such great milk producers or meat producers. It was the leather. And it was a challenge of battle that led to the domestication of cows. People who had better leather did better in battle, because in the ancient days, they had these shields, and the shields were made out of the leather, or they had a leather case about them. And so there would be one army going to battle with sheep's leather on their shields and goat's leather on their shields, but when they faced people with cow's leather on their shields, they lost. So, you know, cows have nice thick leather, and also great for making shoes. You know, not too many of us walk around with sheep's leather for shoes, or goat's leather, but cow leather is great. You get this nice thick leather. And, you know, once they got the leather, they discovered the cow had other purposes as well. But cows are really difficult to domesticate. Ostriches are difficult to domesticate. We're doing it today. And we're discovering that you actually get more hamburger from the ostrich than you get from the cow, a lot more per dollar. It's almost a factor of two. You can make twice as much money if hamburger is your option working with ostriches than you can with cows. But it's really only been in the last few decades anybody said, we'll take on the ostrich. The ostrich is quite a nasty animal to domesticate. But in fact, the only way it really works is you have to raise them from the time they come under the raise. Then they'll, and you've got to make sure they're around one another. They're much easier to deal with if they have lots of their own around them rather than just being isolated. So you don't want to get bit by an adult ostrich. And they can run pretty fast too, as it says here in the text. Let's spend a little bit of time, oh, not much time. I'll get you into the oxen and then we'll talk about it next time. Will a wild ox consent to serve you? Will he stay by your manger at night? Can you hold him at the furrow with a harness? Will he lay till the valleys behind you? Will you rely on him for his great strength? Will you leave your heavy work to him? Can you trust him to bring in your grain and gather it to your threshing floor? So just the four verses here about the ox. But here we're making a transition. Now, you can take a donkey in the wild and domesticate it. What it's saying here, just try that with a cow. Okay, go out into the wild, find an adult wild cow, and see if you're going to be able to successfully domesticate that cow. Now, it's kind of like the ostriches. If you want to make that work, you got to get the cows when they're young. Then you're going to be able to domesticate them. But forget about trying to get some wild cow and make that work. Yeah. Well, that's kind of what you see in each of these paragraphs. The Lord talks about things that's common knowledge about these creatures. So let me ask them some questions. Do you understand why the animal manifests this behavior? Do you know where this behavior came from? Do you know things like the gestation period? So by that, he's exposing some ignorance and saying, you know, if you're really onto this and my command to manage the resources for the benefit of all life, this is stuff you should know. And it's interesting here, it's picking the animals, at least in the context of that time, that are most critical for human well-being. So taking on, and I'm going to talk a little bit about ostriches. You say, well, you know, ostriches, they didn't factor in it at all. But they really did in the context of decoration. They let the ostriches run wild. They didn't bother to domesticate them. But ostrich eggs, were exploited by early humans as well as the feathers. And they really were critical, particularly in parts of Africa, for keeping that economy going. But again, it talks about things we know. We all know that the ostrich can run fast. And we all know that the ostrich really doesn't pay much attention to its age. But then the whole point is, why? Why did I endow certain creatures with wisdom to take care of their young and other creatures without that wisdom? Do you know why? Well, today we can kind of figure it out. Yeah, we know why the ostrich behaves that way. But I can imagine these five scientists sitting there saying, we don't have a clue. And you look at the question the Lord asked, saying, well, we should know this, but we don't. And then the whole point is, where did these creatures come from? Can you explain these creatures from an evolutionary perspective? Do not these creatures, the ox, the horse, the donkey, the deer, the goat, all testify of my providence for you? I mean, that's the main point the Lord is trying to get across. These creatures that you seem to just take for granted are only there because I've so carefully designed them to provide for you. That's the fundamental point. And that's what I would say to a skeptic. You know, this is the point here is not just to say this is amazingly true material in here. The point is, can you explain why these creatures have these properties? Can you do that without invoking the God of the Bible? I think that's the critical point. And we're out of time. So next time we'll talk a little more about oxen, then the ostriches, and then I think the most difficult creature to explain of all in this text is the horse. I mean, why would a horse have these characteristics? Unless, of course, we're talking about a God that knew we humans would need a creature like that. There's no way I can explain the horse from an evolutionary perspective. It just doesn't make sense. And in one sense, I could respond to a skeptic saying, does the behavior of any of these creatures make sense? Unless it is a God providing for us. I mean, these are really strange animals. The way the ostrich behaves, this donkey and this ox, and yet they have these characteristics. Father in heaven, as we look out at your realm of nature, I pray, Father, that you would open up our eyes to see the glory of what you've created and your power and your love and care for us as human beings. Lord, the fact that you created all this life on this planet for our own personal benefit, Lord, that humbles us. It also humbles us to recognize that we've been made responsible by you to take care of all these animals and to take care of this planet. Lord, may we gain more wisdom from you so we can do that with more grace and more care and more love and kindness, not only to ourselves, but to the creatures we serve this planet with us. We want to thank you for creating these creatures and creating the characteristics that they manifest. And Father, help us to use the content of this chapter and these other chapters in the book of Job to more effectively witness to people who don't know you yet as Lord and Savior, that they too would see your glory in creation, and more importantly, your righteousness in creation, and may this cause them to submit their lives to you. In Jesus' name, amen.